Welcome to The Process Podcast, an interview series focused on the process of survival as a creative. Season 6 features conversations with visual artists and curators and gallerists from the Bay Area of California. These conversations took place during a 3-month-long residency at the Growlery, an incredible organization based in San Francisco, who facilitated many of these conversations. They can be found at thegrowlery.org. We have also launched a Patreon for those who want to and are able to provide some financial support for the show to help us keep going. You can learn more about why we've launched that and where the money goes and how it will help us grow at patreon.com/theprocessco. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we hope you dig the season. Cheers, y'all. Hi.
Hello.
Very excited to be back. We missed last week, and I apologize for that. I moved from New York in Austin, not here permanently, but I drove down here. Then we were at Levitation taking photos and interviewing some artists, so I was busy. I did not have time to finish this episode, so we took a week off. Thanks for your patience. We are back, and we're back with a great conversation with Keija Lucas, who is an artist based in the San Francisco Bay Area, who uses photography to explore ideas of home, heritage, and inheritance. She's interested in how ideas are passed down and how seemingly inconsequential moments create changes that last generations. I love that sentence so, so much. Keija also is the program manager at the Growlery in San Francisco, where I recorded this conversation and where I was staying as a resident while I recorded all of the conversations of the season. The Growlery is shifting its focus to support local artists a bit more and will no longer be a residency after March 2020, which I would say is a bummer, but I'm sure whatever they do is going to be very rad. And they already support the local art community so much that I'm sure they will go above and beyond. And I am very excited to follow along with what they do. And if you're interested and that type of thing, you should too. More info about Keija. Her work has been exhibited at a bunch of places. I won't list them all, but they include the Oakland Museum of California, Headland Center for the Arts, San Francisco Arts Commission Galleries, California Institute of Integral Studies, Palo Alto Art Center, and a bunch more, including spots in Italy and Mexico. She's been an artist in residence at a bunch of really prestigious and chill residencies. She's a member of 3.9 Art Collective and on the Curatorial Council at Southern Exposure in San Francisco. She received her BFA from the San Francisco Arts Institute and her MFA from Mills College. We talk about all of that in this convo and walk through her current or active bodies of work. We also talk all about her process, of course, in photography, as well as work she does with scanning. We talk a lot about like how she mixes in these longer lasting, long term projects in her everyday life, the idea of picking up and putting down projects, knowing when to end something, the ethics of photographing people, how her work speaks to the invention of race and categorization, which is super fascinating. If you take anything away from this conversation, I hope you really focus on that part, because yeah, what she does is incredible and impactful and important. We also talk about how everyone is a part of history and her advice for young and emerging artists and a whole bunch more. And a couple other updates about Keija. Oh, she received an individual artist grant from the San Francisco Arts Commission to work on what's now called the Museum of Sentimental Taxonomy. She'll be documenting objects all around the Bay Area next year. So definitely follow along with her to keep up with that. She has some other stuff going on too that she wasn't able to talk about when she gave me her update, but I'm sure she'll be posting about them soon. You can find links to all of her work and social media and everything we talk about at theprocess.co. And yeah, thank you for listening. We'll catch you next week. Cheers, y'all.
My name is Keija Lucas, and I am a visual artist who uses photography. I also run an art space in San Francisco.
Called the Growlery.
Yes, called the Growlery.
Can you elaborate a bit on what type of photography projects you've been working on in the past, I don't know, however long you want.
Several years. So I have 4 bodies of work that I kind of continually work on. I'll just start with one and go through. Yeah. Okay. So In Search of Home, I've been working on probably the longest. Since 2013, I've been traveling to places that are significant to my ancestry and using a flatbed scanner as a camera to make images of botanicals from these places where my ancestors have lived and worked through the time since they arrived in the U.S.
What are some of the places that that's brought you?
My initial trip was a road trip that was like 5,000 miles. I started in Connecticut and drove through New York City, down through the South, Virginia, South Carolina, all the way down to New Orleans, and then I drove back up the Mississippi through Arkansas. I turned left in Iowa and went to western South Dakota. And actually, I had family, like my grandmother grew up in eastern South Dakota, but her nieces lived in western South Dakota, so I wanted to go meet them, which meant I got to see the Badlands too as on a drive-by. I luckily didn't get into a car accident. It's so beautiful. You want to turn your head. Drove from there to Minnesota and met some more cousins, and then Chicago, where I also met cousins there too. And I should say I met second cousins also in like Connecticut and New Jersey as well. So
these are people you hadn't met before.
I'd never met any of them before. I grew up with my like parents and like knowing my grandparents and my siblings, but my parents are both only children. So I didn't really know any second cousins or anything until this trip.
So they're your grandparents, siblings?
Kids. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, yeah. And one of my cousins is like 104. She's actually my grandfather's cousin.
Oh, wow.
I met her when she was 99. Wow. Yeah.
What spurred the desire to
go on that trip? Yeah. That trip started, I guess the jumping off point for it was like well before I started that work. I was in a class as an undergrad where I learned about the work of Carl Linnaeus, who was a Swedish botanist in the 1700s. He's responsible for our modern systems of taxonomy, so like naming systems for plants and animals. In one of his later editions of his book, Systems of Nature, he decided to name and define races of man.
Oh, wow.
The races that he created were very hierarchical and incredibly racist. And at that time in the 1700s, people were using these pseudoscientists' work to justify enslaving Africans. So it was like, 100 or so years into slavery, and they were like, well, let's justify it by that time. But yeah, they were like, we'll just say like, if there's science behind it saying that, these people are worthless, they're not capable of these things, their civilizations are less, which is obviously not true, but it gives them the excuse as people who are like quote unquote Christian stand up people to like enslave other human beings.
Right.
By saying that they're less than human, yeah.
Right.
I wanted to make work about the way that my family, like different branches of my family, have experienced this country in very different ways. I started off by sort of researching that and like where people had lived, and then going to the places. And I should say, since this is the process, before I started this body of work, I was in this weird place where I was like, my work's always so personal, maybe I should make some work that's like more like a concept that's like more like about art or something like that. So I was making scans of botanicals with the plan of perhaps making a body of work about poisonous plants that were used in literature and art history. And then 2 things I discovered. One, I was not interested in making images of poisonous plants because they were, it wasn't that interesting to me, right? It didn't fit in with what my curiosities are. And then also I realized I would probably accidentally kill myself.
Right.
Like, oh, I'll bring hemlock into the studio. Like, that would be really stupid, right? So yeah. I was like, that's not actually interesting to me. But I was like looking at the initial images I made and like thinking about like my dad was a gardener. There were these beautiful little orange flowers that he used to tell me, like, that's a weed, you need to pull it out of the ground. And I always thought it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why is this a weed, but this other plant gets to live? And part of this work is about not only just how different branches of my family have experienced living in this country, but also like how we decide what's beautiful and useful, how these sort of made up systems are a way that we look at the world and then decide, like, this thing, because it is good for people, is useful and beautiful, but this other thing is not good. Or the way that we talk about other groups of people, like the terms native and invasive species, seem very familiar when you think about botanicals, but also groups of people.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a lot of different directions that work sort of came out of, but mostly it's just like traveling and discovering and foraging and finding things to talk about that are from this place, that are like, my DNA is in this dirt, or that like growing through this plant because my ancestors walked on this ground and like sweat in it or right. whatever, you know?
How did you choose what botanicals to pick? Were they just ones that like captured your...
It's everything is like, it captured my eye. Okay. I'd be like, oh, this thistle is really beautiful on the side of the road, so I'm gonna pull over and cut a piece of it. I had to get, with the thistle, I had to get I had to get some leather gloves because it's pokey.
They all capture my eye, but that one has always captured my eye when I look at your work. Probably partially because of color.
Yeah.
But also because it looks like it's pokey as fuck.
Yeah, it's really uncomfortable to touch. So yeah. I think at first I was like, oh, I'm going to just grab this piece of cloth, but like it sticks you through that, so I had to get leather gloves to be able to handle it.
Yeah.
Also, I should say, like, some of the work is not botanical. When I went to Virginia, to a place where it used to be a plantation where my ancestors were enslaved, and I went there, I spent a lot of time on this plantation, or land that was formerly a plantation. I was walking around making pictures. I was 2 weeks into this road trip, questioning what I was doing with my life and like if this work was even interesting. And like, it was hot and I was sweating, like my eyelids were sweating, my pants were sticking to my legs, and I was packing up the car, like just sort of like I'd clipped a bunch of stuff and taken a bunch of pictures. And then like the sky in the south is like pretty amazing, like the clouds and stuff. Yeah. It's like a really gray, cloudy day, and then this like ray of sunshine just like through the clouds, like one of those like God moments, right on this chunk of dirt that was like on this pile that had been dug out from below the foundation of the house that was there. And so I like walked over and I grabbed it and I was like, that's my fucking dirt. And that's the first picture like 2 weeks into the trip that I actually was like, okay, I know what I'm doing here. I'm good to go. And I finally found confidence when I made that. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to scan rather than take?
Oh, so the scans come out of the first photographic book is by this woman, Anna Atkins. Okay. And she made it, it's a book of botanicals. They're cyanotypes. And so they're a contact way of making prints. And they actually are, so sun prints are like, they're blue and you put the thing on top and then the glass. And so she did that with botanicals and she used Carl Linnaeus's taxonomic terms. And it's absolutely beautiful images. And this is like the first photographic book. And it's a book of botanicals and it's a woman artist, right? So I was like, well, I want to call back to that. Well, scanning is not a form of direct print. It's not a contact print, but it is a contact way of making an image. So I felt like it was sort of like calling back to that. I also feel like making scans is like, it's kind of a beautiful way to make a photograph. The way the light works with the scanner is like very even and it falls off in a really beautiful way. It kind of reminds me of like older paintings, like the Dutch masters, like if you see like the way that you can see the roundness and stuff and something. And also another interesting thing that happens with it is if a object moves while the scanner is going, it creates this digital artifacting where it separates the colors. So there's a thing there. It just looks kind of like a rainbow or like digital glitches. And so I leave those things in to sort of remind you that this is a photograph and remind you that these things are flawed. I started off with these like really clean images that were like, I'm referring to these botanical drawings and like Anna Atkins' work, and I want it to be like really clean. But then when I started seeing what happened when like the dirt or dust was falling off of the object, it was really interesting and it pulled away from that. I often start off with like some serious rules for myself and then I'm soon breaking them. I liked the way that worked and how it takes away from that cleanness of the idea of a scientific drawing or a scientific image and sort of reminds you what it is. And I also don't pick perfect specimens. I pick what draws my eye.
And were you only exploring your dad's side or both?
No, I explored all parts of my family. So the cousins that I met in Connecticut and New Jersey were my mom's cousins. And I spent time in Brooklyn in a park that was like across the street from where one of the apartments where my grandmother grew up there. And yeah, I went to like New Jersey to see like part of like where my grandfather grew up there too. So yeah.
And your heritage is like a wild
It's
mix,
very
right?
like, well, my mom's whole side of the family is Russian, Polish, and Moldova, mm-hmm. which is like all like Eastern European Jews. And then my dad's side of the family is African American and English.
Was this your first project out of school?
No, it wasn't. But I will say this is my first. So the four bodies of work that I work on right now are all long-term bodies of work. Okay. And before this, before In Search of Home, I would make maybe like 20 pictures or 11 pictures or something. And then I would be like, okay, I feel like that body of work's done. And I would move on. And this is the first time that I've like stuck with something. Like I've been working on it since 2013, which is a really long time for someone to continue working on a body of work. But I also don't work on it every day of the year. Like I switch between things, and it's also like making work in the Bay Area that has to do with this work, but also like returning to places in different seasons if I can. Like I would really like to go back to the South again. And maybe even wrap this up, I don't know. But we'll see what happens.
It'd be interesting if you showed it in one of the places where your family like has roots, right? Or multiple of the places.
I would love to do something like that. I'm hoping also to go to some of those places and find the cash crops that were grown on the plantations. But also, yeah, like going to like South Dakota and like where my grandmother grew up, they have like a college there and stuff like that. Would be cool to do that. Where, especially considering like my grandmother's, her story and her background, or like she went to her master's at Iowa State.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so.
So that's a great segue. Let's bop to the project for your grandma.
Okay, cool. So
that's a good segue.
The project about my grandmother, which is a different grandmother than we were just talking about, it's called Collections from Sundown. She lived with Alzheimer's disease, well, probably for longer, but that diagnosed for 11 years. Mm. One of the things that happens when people have Alzheimer's disease is that they, in the evenings or in the wintertime when it starts getting dark, they'll collect things and carry it around the house with them. It's really difficult to be the person who has Alzheimer's. It's also really difficult to be a loved one of that person and watch them suffering through this. And I wanted a way to talk about it that was respectful of her. I wasn't interested in making portraits of her as she was getting more confused or her realities were changing. And when we started noticing her doing this packing thing, my mother, who's her main caregiver, I would ask her to take a photograph. So one day she was carrying like 9 coats around. So my mom would take a photograph with her phone and text it to me. So next time I would go down and visit, they lived 45 minutes away. So I'd go down and visit and I would take everything that was in my text messages and I would reset it up into still lives and name them after that day. So there's a photograph of a pile of coats and it's named after whatever day she was carrying the pile of coats. Or I would open her suitcase and see what she had packed in it. And then...
Is there research that you know behind why...
Why that happened?
Yeah.
No, but I've read a lot about it happening. Like someone, they feel like they just got dropped off there or they're going to get picked up soon.
Okay.
So there's like
places
like in the...
Kind of
like
morbid when you think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's places, I want to say it's in the Netherlands, but I could be wrong, where they have a whole setup thing. Like someone put a bench outside that no bus goes to.
Oh, wow.
So like the people in the senior living facility will walk out there, sit on the bench because they think they're going somewhere, and then someone will come out and sit next to them on the bus and eventually get them to go back inside.
Right.
So eventually my grandmother stopped collecting things as much. And another thing that she had been doing And I asked my mom to hold on for me as well, was all of these notes she would write, and she would leave them on the kitchen table or around to remind herself of things, to ask my mom questions, to let people know where she was. I'm going for a walk, I'm back. Maps that she drew of like how to get to the dentist's office. Questions like, is this my tooth that's in my pocket? Or like all of these different things about like what's going on with her car, or when she had stopped driving quite a while before. So all of these different things, and you can see in her handwriting, because she was born in 1919, so she had this like really beautiful penmanship.
Yeah.
Because you were required to at that time. And you can see the deterioration of the handwriting over the years. So I photographed these notes, I arranged them in ways that sort of tell a story, like maybe the repetition of how being in a conversation with somebody with Alzheimer's would be, but also how their brain is sort of in these kind of scattered way, you know? So sometimes groupings of notes, trying to arrange them in a way, but then it's kind of messy still. And then also often singular notes that might be grouped together if they were shown, like the singular ones in a way that mimics the other images. Some of the notes repeat in different places. And like when I exhibited the work, I would be like, okay, so this note here that has this list or whatever is also going to appear somewhere else in a different image, in a different part of the show. And this work is, my grandmother passed away over the summer. So this is, I feel like I'm just completing it. I just took a few more images last month in January, and I feel like I have all of the work that I'm going to make from it. I needed to bring it to a close. I was holding on to it, I feel like. And then I was like, you know, I think it's time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about bringing things to a close. How old was she?
98. She was 98, yeah. She didn't quite make it to 99.
Okay.
She was, like, such a smart lady and, like, so with it and so independent. And this was, like, really difficult to see.
I can imagine. But also, like, I think it says a lot that she was so with it, even with Alzheimer's, or she was making notes, like coherent notes about.
Oh yeah. And some like, of it was like, there's one you can see that says like, I don't think anything's wrong with my memory right now. Let's cancel this appointment. Mm. But she had gone to the appointment already.
Oh.
But they say that people with Alzheimer's and dementia who are like well educated and like keep doing crossword puzzles and stuff, you have more synapses in your brain that are connecting the two sides of your brain.
Okay.
And so that there will be a longer time that you sort of like go around the way that your brain would normally figure things out.
Okay.
But eventually it got to the point where that wasn't happening anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing that I should say is like a lot of the notes will say like Wednesday or November 2nd, but they don't have a year on them. Mm-hmm. So I'd like that it's sort of you're in all of this time at one time.
Yeah.
You know, like sometimes they're arranged by like what the note's about, but like never like the time period, they're all mixed up in there. Yeah.
So like photography is obviously a documentary thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's different ways you can do that, right? You can either just be like capturing a place and like making beautiful object or whatever, beautiful photos, or is what drew you to it like this ability to document these very like real and
it's interesting because I very much started off photographing people, and I still feel like I am in a way, like even though there's no people in my photographs, it's about people, it's about how ideas are passed down, it's about like how we hold on to who we are, how we figure out what home is. But there used to be a lot more people in my photographs, and they sort of made their way out over the years. And I think part of that has to do with like figuring out the ethics of photographing people, right? Like what does it mean to make a portrait of someone? But also that I felt like I could make these stories feel like people could walk up to it and see their own experience with a person with Alzheimer's. Or they might walk up to someone and be like, oh, shit, that's how one of the ways that race was invented. That's an invented thing. Like, I just thought it always was. And, like, think about their own ancestry and how that has affected who they are. So I feel like that sort of making images of the object is, like, such a portrait, but also, like, allows the viewer to sort of step in a way that isn't necessarily like othering the subject, I guess.
Yeah. This is a stupid, like in the weeds question, but something I've been wondering a lot the past like month and a half. In galleries and stuff, including like the SFAI show, there's not like a plaque that explains your work.
Okay, so some places do put that. A lot of times you have to look in a binder.
Okay.
Which I guess for some people, they want like a huge statement next to the work.
Yeah.
I kind of thought it was interesting because like the show at SFAR or this other show that I have work in, like people might walk up to it and think like, oh, this is about plants, right?
Right.
Or this is, you make an assumption about what it is about.
Or about and a particular place rather than.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like kind of that somebody might walk up to it and look at it and take it for what it is at first and then look into more of like, why is this here? Like, what is this fitting into? And spend more time than they might if they saw the thing on the wall. So like looking into it, asking questions about it, like had a conversation with somebody at that opening at SFAI where they were like, the invention of race, like that's not something that I've ever heard about or thought about. And I was just like, yeah, you know, like people have not been thinking about race in this way for like more than a few hundred years. There are specific reasons why we do. So I felt like that was important. And some galleries insist on having a didactic next to the work, and others are more like aesthetically it doesn't look right. And for the one at SFAI, I was asked like, how do you feel about wall labels? And I was like, it's up to the curator.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's their aesthetic decision.
So you kind of like it if it like weeds out the people or weeds in the people who...
Yeah, I feel like there's like a lot of interesting conversations I've had. And I'll also say that this work gets put a lot of times with like other work that is botanicals.
Yeah.
But I like that. I feel really honored that people saw it for what it's about and like put it into shows that are more about like what the race work is and, actually yeah. like talking about, you know, like categorization and all of that stuff. And yeah.
Totally. But a lot of that takes like you getting out there and talking about it, right?
Oh, it does. Yeah. People don't necessarily see that right away.
So even some of your friends might not know if they've never asked.
Yeah.
If they're not like stalking your website for whatever.
Yeah, definitely. Yet. And I've gotten into conversations with people too, would be like, cause I'll show like, oh yeah, I have this like thistle next to like something that is like purposefully beautiful grown into somebody's yard or whatever. Right. They're like, well, there is a natural hierarchy in, like, the plant and animal kingdom. And I'm like, that is interpreted by who and create, you know what I'm saying? Is there really, or is it, like, what's natural or useful to human beings
right.
who are in power, I should say. Yeah. Not all of us, but folks in power. So, yeah. I feel like it creates interesting conversations because people feel like they want to walk up to it. They don't quite know what's going on.
Totally.
Yeah.
Cool. You want to explain some more of your work?
Sure. I have a body of work called Objects to Remember You By, an Index of Sentiment. And it's sort of like it's a very long ongoing project where I photograph people's sentimental objects.
Yeah.
And I'll bring a studio setup to a space and ask people to bring sentimental objects and ask them about those objects. I originally wanted to sit down with different people for coffee for an hour and then talk to them about life and then photograph a sentimental and a utilitarian object that they use every day. Mm. And then I realized quickly how unreasonable that was going to be to do. Making appointments with busy people when you're a busy person yourself, like where I still love to get coffee with someone for an hour. Actually, I wasn't making the work in the way I wanted. So I found that like setting up in a space and asking people who are often strangers to come have their sentimental objects photographed and also people I know creates really interesting conversations. I get to have a pretty intimate conversation with a stranger or learn something new about a friend or an acquaintance. It's also set up like when I exhibit the work, and hopefully I'll actually get funding soon-ish to create an online museum, but when I exhibit the work, it's meant to look like a museum. Yeah. I don't feel like museums are necessarily places that feel welcoming to everyone. I feel like we don't all feel represented in there. Yeah, galleries also.
Galleries are even worse, maybe.
Yeah, true that. Yeah, and it's funny, well, this work, no commercial gallery would ever show because it's the only work that I don't put a price tag on.
Yeah.
I'm, like, not interested in selling it. Mm-hmm. Unless, like, someday, like, an actual museum wanted to buy the whole thing.
Right.
But, you know. Anyways, so when I exhibit the work, I exhibit it in ways that you would exhibit objects in museums. So on shelves, in vitrines, etc. And I want it to be a way that feels like everyday people who brought their objects to be photographed are represented in this piece. Mm-hmm. So we have a canon of people who decide like what is important to hold on to, what stories are important to tell and retell. And what I'm saying here is like everybody is also a part of history. And so let's see what is important to anyone who's interested in participating.
Yeah.
I really enjoy making the work and plan to just continue with it as far as like, as long as I'm still interested and like can keep moving and doing it, I feel like I could work on it for my whole life.
I do want to ask you about when to know when to end something, before that, do you still do like the utilitarian object they use every day?
I don't.
Or is it just sentimental? Okay.
No, that was like maybe there were like 5 people that I did with, and then I was like, this is not going to work. I just asked for sentimental objects.
Okay.
So I think that's also like, it talks to like things we hold on to and like, why do we hold on to things?
Yeah.
You know, like there are a lot of things that it's like, why do I, you know, we were talking about the Marie Kondo thing earlier. Not all sentimental objects spark joy.
Right.
I've heard a lot of stories about things that are actually like kind of difficult that people hold on to them. But there are reasons why we, like, hold on to things and carry them through our lives. And, like, that maybe you feel more at home if you have this thing with you. And maybe it reminds you of a loved one. Maybe it reminds you of something not so great. But it's, like, you feel the need to, like, carry it with you. And so maybe it's, like, joy and maybe it's a burden.
Yeah.
But
not to make this about me, but, like, hearing you talk about the project, I was thinking, I'm like, what would I want photographed, especially that I carry around with me as I travel, right?
Yeah.
And my ring that was my mom's and my grandma's has my grandma's name engraved in it. That's worth like $30, but it's obviously important to me.
Yeah.
And actually this ring too has some random relatives. My dad's camera that I've been using. And then if I was to pick a utilitarian object that I use every day, it'd be this fucker, my computer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm like, it'd be really interesting to put all those things together, especially because my mom and my dad met, because my dad like had a camera around his neck.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing, but
my dad's camera I still have too. I learned how to, I took my first photography class because I inherited my dad's camera when he died, and I was like, oh, I should learn how to use this. I thought I would just take one class, and then I just like kept going with it. So,
you were like 19 then, right?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm like repeating my story.
No, I only know that because I was stalking your website.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so ending things.
Oh, ending things.
Ending projects. Like, how do you know? What are your thoughts on that? Do you feel that you need to end? Like, what's your...
No, I don't know. I feel like with the work about my grandmother collections from Sundown, I felt like that came to a close. There are certain things that I just maybe was like, oh, I'll put this on hold for a minute. So there's some stuff that I like actually have been thinking about picking up again that I haven't worked on for years that I'm like, oh, I don't quite think I did that in a way that I like now. Yeah. Looking back, I feel like I made some decisions that I would like to rethink.
Mm-hmm.
And since it's like still my work and my ideas, I'm like, I can do this again in a way that I appreciate more. And also some things I'm just like, okay, I did that. Like I tried it. I'm no longer interested in it. And then the work with my collections from Sundown, I was just like, this is, like, my grandmother's life came to an end. Like, she hasn't written notes for a couple years, probably. We'll find stuff around every once in a while. But I needed to, like, wrap that up. And I also feel, like, In Search of Home, probably after I, like, take another trip down south, maybe I'll feel ready with that as well. I think it's, like, as long as you're still curious and interested and the work is still growing, I think it's good to keep going with something. But if you feel like you just have to because people told you they like it or something, that's not a good reason to keep going. It's like, it's okay to put something down. And it's okay to like pick it up 10 years later if you're like, oh, I decided I want to keep going with this, you know? But yeah, I definitely used to be like, oh, I made 20 images. Like, that's good. I don't need to make any more. But there are certain things where it just feels like you've kind of worked out the idea and then it doesn't feel like you need to make it anymore. Or it changes form.
Right.
Because I feel like I've been making the same work for a really long time, but it changes form with the way I make it changes, you know?
Yeah.
They're about similar things, but I'm like, oh, well, what if I tweaked this, and then it's a whole nother body of work, you know.
Do you do your art strictly for you?
What do you mean by that?
Like, what motivates you to create?
I feel like making art for me is, like, I am in desire to have conversation with it. Okay. Visual communication is, like, the way I learned how to communicate with the world. So making photographs was, like, the first way I was like, oh, I can make this thing, and I can kind of express whatever is going on in my head in a way that maybe I would be too shy to express verbally or whatever. So I do want to be a part of a conversation, but I wake up and go to the studio for me. Right. Because this drives me. It keeps me going. When I don't make work for a long period of time, I get depressed. Yeah. And I feel like, what am I, like, why am I not doing this? And even before I, like, fully identify, it took me a long time to, like, feel like I fully identify as an artist, like, probably after grad school. Mm-hmm. Not to say I wasn't an artist before that. It was just, like, a scary thing to claim, yeah. You know? Like, do I deserve to say this? It just felt like something that I wasn't sure if I was allowed to claim. And now when someone's, like, 6 and they like to make art, I'm like, are you an artist? And they're like, I don't know. And I'm like, it looks like it to me.
Yeah.
It's fine, you know? Totally. I do also think it's hard work. And when people are like, everyone's an artist. And I'm like, no, they're not, actually.
Do you think everyone's creative?
I don't necessarily think everyone is. I don't want to shame people who feel not creative. Like, yeah. I feel like there are people who I know. I have a friend I was talking to last night, and she was like, I am not a creative person. Like, I have no desire to do those things. It's not interesting to me. I appreciate when other people are. I appreciate their skill and what they can do. But it's not, and I'm like, yeah, that's cool.
Does that person, like, solve problems? I feel like
a lot of people. Oh, yeah, creative problem solver. Creative. Of course, yeah.
And that's exercising creativity, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I think
not
that.
Not visually.
Yeah, and I think there are people who have studied art too who don't make work anymore, yeah. But use those, like, problem solving skills that they've learned as an artist in their past life to, like, solve problems in their current life.
Totally.
So, yeah, I think so. I think, yes, in that way, like, definitely problem solving and like figuring out how to fucking communicate with people is, yeah. Like,
which is, like, the hardest thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. exactly.
So you were 19 when you got, yeah, your dad's camera, and yeah, then you took a photography class.
Yeah.
At what point did you decide to, like, what did you think you were going to do with your life at that point? And at what point did you decide to go to art school?
Okay, so when I was 19, first I should say, like, I dropped out of high school when I was 15. Right. Like, I went to, like, a continuation school for a few months, and they had fourth grade books, and I was like, oh, this isn't really necessary for me to come here anymore. So I, like, worked, and I thought, like, I'll get a job doing something, or maybe I'll, like, go to college for sociology. Mm. Actually, when I was 17, I took that test of, like, what would you be good at?
Yeah.
And I tested as that I should be a preschool teacher, which is the wrong job for me. I think at the time I really liked kids, and I was like, okay. I babysat a lot and stuff, but then I, like, took a few classes and, like, was like, this is not for me, that I wouldn't be happy. I would have these, like, kind of corporate jobs, like mortgage and at a software company and then an insurance, and I would always, like, start at the front desk and get promoted and then hate my job and cry every day on the way to work. Yeah. So I forced my brother to take this black and white photo class, which is mostly what there was at the time. We took this darkroom class. He was way better than I was at it. He had been in school. He's a couple years older than me, and he's, like, a constant student. Okay. Like, he's still in school. He's either teaching or in school.
This isn't your brother here.
No, right? No, it's my brother in Oregon. Yeah. And but I was like, please take this class with me. So we took it, and I, like, passed it. It was the first class I had passed since I was 15.
Oh, wow.
And then, like, a quarter off, and then I was like, oh, I'll take the second photography class. And I did that, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. And then I would just take a class, like, every other quarter. And, like, in that time period, too, I, like, was like, oh, I'll try to go to school for sociology, and then I was like, oh, this is not for me, and then I would, like, drop out or whatever. And then finally I had a quarter, because we were in the quarter system, at a quarter where I took 3 classes, like, not full-time, but, like, 9 units or something at night. and I passed all of them. In that same time, I was working for an insurance company, and my boss had called me into her office and say, like, we want to send you to insurance school so you can get your license to sell insurance. And I was living with my grandmother at the time. I went home and cried to her and said, Grandma, I could get this job. I could make good money. Like, I could, you know, pay all my bills, but I don't want to do this with my life. I'm not happy.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay, well, if you want to go to college, you can stay with me for a couple more years and finish at community college. Oh. So I went and gave notice at my job the next day and then started at summer school. Like, I always used to think, like, oh, well, I'll just take one or two more classes and then I'll feel like I'm a photographer and maybe I'll have a portrait business. And then I was like, well, maybe I should finish my associate's degree just in case I drop out during my bachelor's. So then I finished that, and then I like transferred to art school, and I would be like, every semester was like one semester at a time, you know, whatever, but there was something about it that I just wanted to keep going back.
Yeah. And you get your master's.
Yeah, and then a couple years of being out of school, I was like, all right, time to go back and get the master's. Now I have no desire to ever be a student again.
Yeah.
Like, a lifelong learner, yes. A student, no. I'm like, see people doing homework, and I'm like, oh, I'm glad I'm not doing that right now. Yeah.
What made you go to grad school? Like, what did you think that's going to help your career, or did you just
feel like
you needed to refine?
I think so. I think there are a lot of things, and I don't necessarily think they were the right reasons.
Yeah.
One was, I was like, I just want to figure out how to be a full-time artist for a couple years. Get myself. I mean, I do think that's actually a good reason.
Yeah.
I thought I wanted to teach. Like, I was teaching already, like, a lot of supplemental education. And then I was working in a reading program at a high school. But I wanted to teach art more. I thought it would give me, yeah, just, like, sort of get me in the practice of a studio practice.
Yeah.
And then just meeting a community. So I guess these are good reasons to go to grad school. I wanted to find a community of artists. But at the same time, when I first started, I remember thinking, like, my cohort in grad school is amazing and we're still friends. Certain people I don't see that often. If I do see them, I'll be so stoked to see them. And, like, a lot of us are in regular touch.
Yeah.
So I feel like I did find a community there. And that was something I was looking for. But I was also, like, worried that I wouldn't get along with anyone and that it was going to be awful. I was like, okay, so maybe I'm going to go here for 2 years and just, like, be by myself. We'll figure it out.
Mm.
And when I got there, it was terrifying. I had never had a studio before.
Mm.
For the first month or so of my first semester of grad school, I would print old negatives in the darkroom and watch Big Love in my studio.
Mm.
And just, like, people would be like, okay, I'm going to go back to my studio. And I'd be like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Mm. So I'd just go back and, like, watch movies in there. And, like,
does every grad student, like, get their own studio?
Like, yeah, at the school where I was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, actually, they have, like, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Studio. This is the best one I've had since then.
Wow.
It's close. But yeah, it's definitely it was scary.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Everyone I asked about it, nobody had, like, very few people I talked to about it had an actual MFA. Like, so I was, like, asking friends who didn't have an MFA to look at my work and look at my application.
Mm.
And, like, talking to them about, like, what I thought it, so I didn't have advice from, what I should have done is, like, gone to more people who were,
yeah,
had done that. Peers. You know, yeah.
Or even gone to your teachers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what do I do with this piece?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I feel like it was definitely a good choice for me to do. I don't think it's necessary or it's for everyone, but
yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to switch gears a bit, but also related, and talk about, like, the artist community stuff and the growlery.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Can you explain a bit about
the growlery?
The growlery, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm the programs manager, which is a made-up title. I was asked, like,
I'm glad that's your title, because that's what I call you.
Okay.
Like, I didn't really know.
Well, I was like, I feel like a director, like, decides on budgets, and that's not, like, a thing that I do. So I was like, yeah. So the growlery is an artist residency and exhibition space in a Victorian era, I won't call it a mansion, but a big fucking house.
Big-ass house.
In San Francisco. What I do there is I set up the residency and the exhibition. So before I started, I created the application system, and then we brought on the first jury. So, like, before I started at the job, it was an invitation only residency. And part of that was that they were just trying to figure out for the first couple of years, like, what is this? What are we doing here? And, like, not wanting someone to spend the time on an application and then get there and be like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
So I was like, I didn't want it to be like, hey, I'm going to just have all my homies come, and make, as fun as that would be,
yeah.
I just thought it would be better to, like, professionalize, like, that part of it, and, but just, like, to make it so it was, like, more open to different artists that maybe we wouldn't have seen their work before.
Right, to make it a true community resource rather than
your
specific community.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, like, I think they did a pretty good job at that before. Like, there was, like, the guy who did my job before, and then also the founder, like, would both find people from different places, but I just felt like, let's just open it up. So I do that, I help get the jury together, make sure that the house doesn't fall down, that everything's working properly, that there's toilet paper and stuff there, make sure that the artists are feeling comfortable at home and have everything they need to get their work done. That's really important. I've been to a lot of residencies, and I feel like having a warm, safe place to lay your head does a lot for being able to be creative. We have a lot of rumors about, like, how artists like to struggle. It's not true. We just often have to, because what we do isn't necessarily lucrative, and there's no, like, beaten path for it. The other thing that I do with, well, another part of that, the residency side of it, is, like, connecting with other community organizations. So sometimes, like, last year we had a couple artists that were doing things at the Arts Commission Gallery, so they came and stayed with us for a few nights, or through Soundwave, some folks came, and then also, we'll have some people from Southern Exposure there this year. So just, like, letting folks know, like, hey, if you have someone that's coming to install or coming to do a performance, like, we have space, a guest room or whatever, and they're welcome to come stay with us and do the work while they're here. And, like, other residencies that maybe have a studio space but not a living space too. That's a lot of what I do on that side. And then we also have exhibitions. So I won't call myself a curator, because it's more like asking the artist, like, what do they want to do, and helping them figure out what's feasible,
right,
and then helping them execute it.
You're not necessarily, right, choosing the work.
I'm not going to choose the work. I will give my opinion. Like, there's sometimes artists who are maybe, like, a little bit less experienced with exhibiting their work, or, like, editing down, or, like, figuring out certain things. So some people need me to be a little bit more hands-on, and then some people are just, like, very independent, know what they want. And then there's some people who are like, I know what I want, and I need your help, and this is what it is. So I'm kind of there to, like, figure that stuff out. And then I do publicity, get the shows on the calendars and stuff, and then, like, just hosting the openings and different programming for the artists. Also, like, the founder, Jean Chadbourne, is often there during the openings, but she just had a baby, so they haven't been there for the last couple months. Yeah.
A lot of people I, like, run into or interview or whatever who know about the Growlery are, like, such an important organization, and we, like, it's a shame that more of that doesn't exist in the city, and it's, like, truly playing a role in, like, maintaining some level of culture here. That's not a question, it's a statement, but...
No, I feel like that's what Jean's goal was when she started it, and there are certain things that we're able to do that other organizations wouldn't be able to do because it's privately funded.
Right.
Like, we're not a nonprofit, and so there's certain things that can happen that maybe wouldn't be able to happen if we were accounting 100% on, like, grants and donations.
Yeah.
Like, we don't take a cut from artists' work when it sells.
Right.
You know, those types of things. I think, like, just, like, being like, okay, like, this is what, you know, and I think a lot of organizations, nonprofits, are struggling to survive in a place where they have to worry about rent. But since she owns the house, that's not as much of an issue. Like, we're not worried about, like, in 10 years, our landlord's going to kick us out or whatever. And as you know, like, sometimes, like, residents will still have to do their regular job, yeah, while they're there, but it's still, like, something about, like, the change of space and also, like, having some time and expectation to make work too.
Totally.
Like, sometimes being like, oh yeah, you have a show coming, so you're gonna do this, and you're being around other creative people and just being able to have conversations with other creative people and make connections and, yeah, like, broaden that community, I think is, like, a huge part of residencies. And I spent a year on residencies the year before I was a resident at the Growlery, and I had a lot of, like, hey, like, this would be really cool kind of ideas or whatever. So when I started, I kind of was like, okay, like, it's kind of my job to, like, make sure that the artists are are taken care of, and that this program is something that this city and this in the Bay Area, which I was born, I was like raised here, like yeah. I grew up here, and it means so much to me to support. So like while I'm playing this role in it, just sort of helping to funnel opportunities towards people who need them has been like a really amazing thing for me.
Yeah, being from the Bay Area, some of the changes that have taken place and how, if they've impacted you, as well as like the whole how you make it work thing, which I know we talk about personally all the time.
It has changed a lot. Like I grew up in the South Peninsula, like in Palo Alto and Mountain View, and moved to San Francisco in 2004. And at the time I could afford to have a tiny studio apartment in the Tender Knob by myself. And then like a really affordable apartment.
Tender Knob?
Yeah, it's the Tender Loyan and Knob Hill. Okay. I lived on Bush and Jones for my first year. My first year in San Francisco, I sold my car and I was like, I want to live somewhere where I walk out the front door and there's sidewalk.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. So paid $825 a month. And then like I had a suite flat in the Mission with friends that our rent was like ridiculously reasonable.
Yeah.
And when I left there, like moving to Oakland, it was like reasonable. And now like thinking about like what I'm going to do next in my life, I don't know that I'll ever be able to afford to live alone again if I stay here.
And here being the Bay Area, not just San Francisco. Yeah,
not just San Francisco proper. Oakland is too expensive for me to like find a place and move in by myself. I could possibly find someone who has a lease that is already rent controlled and needs a roommate.
Yeah,
I've been lucky, like the how you make it thing. First of all, I have to say, like, sometimes I get help when I need it. Like, if I'm like, hey, I have no money for food or gas, like, I have definitely asked my brother for a sandwich before, or my mother has helped me with my bills before. So I don't want to, like, make it seem like I don't get any help, but it's a serious hustle, and it does feel like the options get fewer and fewer, and it feels like we lose people who are important to our community often because they can't afford to live here anymore, or because they're not willing to work this hard to make it work anymore, or, you know, like better opportunities elsewhere. And so they have to move on. And it's funny because like, I don't know where I would go, but I also like, I'm constantly like, oh my gosh, this is really hard. And I don't always look up and see that because I'm like grinding.
You're in it. Yeah.
And so
and
I'm like,
it's like real life for you, right?
It's funny because I used to say like when people would move here from like Portland and they're used to their $300 a month rent, and then they see a room for $700 and they're like, that's so expensive, I don't want to pay that. And I would be like, I grew up somewhere that's more expensive to live, so that seems reasonable to me. But now when it's like $2,000 for a room or $1,500 for a room, I'm like, that doesn't feel reasonable to me.
There was a sign in front of Vinyl Cafe for a one-bedroom apartment in that building, $3,500.
That's outrageous, right? Like, you're supposed to make three times the amount of your rent per month. And
how many people are making fucking $10,000?
Yeah.
How many artists are making $10,000?
Yeah, it's one of these things where it's just like, I mean, even people who are like doing pretty well at their jobs.
Yeah.
But it's not just artists either. It's like teachers who work in the city, a lot of them can't afford to live here.
Right.
Bus drivers are commuting from like hours away.
Like, and the city needs teachers, it needs bus drivers. Like, what the fuck?
I mean, even I talk to Uber drivers who will be like, or like whatever, Lyft drivers, ride share drivers, who will be like, oh yeah, I like come out from Fresno and stay in my car three nights a week so that, because it's like a bigger hub, people need drivers, but they're just like doing these things to just hustle.
Kind of part of the problem.
They are. I do agree with that. Yeah. I think we need more bus drivers.
Taking advantage of, yeah.
Yeah, but it's just like, but people sometimes who like used to live here, who are like, I had to move to Antioch, but I'll come back to drive in San Francisco.
And maybe used to be like cab drivers or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's, I think, yeah, that's a difficult thing.
Yeah,
you can't call a cab anymore. They don't show up.
Yeah.
But yeah, like people who are like coming from all over the place to do the jobs that are in San Francisco, and then people living in San Francisco taking the bus down to Mountain View to go to their job down there. You know, it's like, it's pretty, it can be really frustrating. It feels like being squeezed and being like, okay, how long will it be until it pops or I pop? I don't know.
Is that kind of what you're waiting for?
I don't know. Like I don't know the bubble's going to ever burst.
Yeah.
I never want to count on that. Just because things have happened in a certain way in the past doesn't mean that it hasn't figured its way around. I don't know how long I'll be able to stay for, but I'm hustling and trying to stay and do it because this is at home.
Yeah.
So like, and I have like a baby nephew who's 2 months old and right. I like want, and my, you know, my niece is graduating from high school and I like want to be able to like be close to my family, you know. I used to think like, oh, I'll be around at least until my grandmother passes, but now I'm like, you know, like I have all these people that I like, I want to know them.
Yeah.
You know, like I want to know my nephew as he gets older, right. You know, so being close by is the best way. I mean, FaceTime is good too, but, and then I go to other places and I'm like, this isn't the same. This is not like home, you know, and like there are places. Here. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. I mean, this rain today is not, I'm not feeling it so much, but, and I also realize though that a huge part of being here is the community that I have worked very hard to create around me. I'm not saying I created the Bay Area art community. Please don't think that. But like, I work really hard to create and maintain friendships with people to know what's going on here in the arts and stuff. Part of me is like, well, that's one of the reasons why I stay. But then I hear friends talking about like, oh yeah, I'm taking a job interview in Arizona because maybe I could actually get a job there.
Yeah.
Teaching or whatever. In a way, I'm staying for this community that there's no guarantee that anyone's going to still be here, you know? So, I mean, I can't count on that, but right now it's what I'm going to work towards is like figuring that out. Yeah.
Totally. Especially, and we've talked about this a little bit before in the past, but like, it's not always easy finding a community that you feel comfortable with and and you found it. So
yeah. And I think like, it's funny because like I'll go to a city like New York and it feels so alive and I'm like, this place is awesome. I love it here. I could live here. But then I realize it's just as hard of a hustle.
Yeah.
And I don't have my people there.
Right.
Like I know some people there, but it's not the same. Even in places that feel like they support the arts more than the Bay, sometimes I'm just like, oh, well, I would still have to work so hard to create a new community, which I don't have any desire to, and I don't know if it would be possible for me to create art in a vacuum, you know, like without that support surrounding me, you know,
inspiration,
like someone to call and be like, oh my God, I need to walk out of the studio. Do you want to get lunch? You know what I'm saying? And then just talk about like whatever's going on world or in the studio or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
And to pay your bills, a hustle for you is the gallery, obviously, and then documenting people's work.
I document artwork. I also pick up jobs here and there doing stuff for people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but mostly the gallery and documenting art. Sometimes I teach classes, photography or Photoshop, which is often also photography. Sometimes I go talk in people's classes and that gives me like a little bit of money too. So that's nice.
Yeah. You know, I've heard you say before that you don't sell that much of your work.
Mm-mm.
And is that, and that you don't market it?
Well, okay. So like I would sell my work. I just don't know how to like, I don't have a gallery. I'm not
like. Would
you
want to be represented by a gallery?
It really depends.
Okay.
Like, to be honest, like I'm open to all kinds of things at this point. I do sell like maybe a couple pieces a year, but not that much.
Mm-hmm.
I would be open to working with a gallery if it was the right place. I would be open to all kinds of stuff. People will say like, oh, you should get an art consultant who will like place your work in different places. And I'm like, that sounds great. But then it's like this weird thing where you're like, cool, should I... Maybe I'll email someone and they're like, oh, you should get introduced. And then it's like, oh, would you introduce me? Well, I really can't introduce you. So it's like one of those things where it's just like, you know, we do our best to support each other. But then there's a certain point where it's just like, okay, like, where is it? And like, where's the line crossing? So I'm like, okay. And I know damn well that I'm not Jackson Pollock in like upstate New York and like someone's going to come discover me. So I have to be louder about it. But like, I'm working on, you know, getting my work out in the world. I apply to a lot of things, and luckily lately I've been invited to a lot of things too, to exhibit the work. So hopefully more of that will come up. Yeah.
Is that what your advice would be to an artist who does want to like sell more of their work or at least show it? It's just like applying to like.
I don't know if I would. I don't know if I could give anyone advice on like selling more of their work.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I probably could, but it wouldn't be from my own experience. It would be from watching other people.
Right.
I guess the advice that I would give to young artists that want to like get their work out there is, first of all, like always make sure that when it is out there, that it's at the best that it could be. So when you're exhibiting your work, you want to show it in the best way you can afford to show it. Get good documentation of it, so when you apply to things, then people will be able to see it as it's meant to be seen. Even if that happens to be like with your iPhone, still like take it in the computer and make sure that it's color balanced or whatever. And then yeah, apply to things that make sense for your work. Like, I think a lot of young artists make the mistake of being like, oh, there's a show at this place, there's a call for work about this thing, and I'm gonna try to make my concept fit into that thing. Why do that? Instead, see if there's stuff that actually really fits it, so you're not like kind of finagling your statement to fit it in. And I think also, like, right now, like, I grew up feeling like I needed to wait my turn, and I feel like that was a mistake. It was just sort of the way that I always felt, like, in wherever I was, I always felt like I needed to wait my turn, don't want to be in the way, etc. And I think, like, show up to things, let people know who you are, and in whatever way that is. If you're shy, volunteer and, like, help with stuff. If you're, like, schmoozy and, like, outgoing and an extrovert, like, show up and, like, introduce yourself in another way. And there's no, like, specific pathway for an artist.
Yeah.
And don't pay too much money for application fees, but definitely apply to things.
Someone actually gave me the same piece of advice about grants, too. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's worth saying, is that figure out the point, like, know the point of your work.
Yeah.
And come up with like, for me, it was about writing. So she suggested coming up with a proposal first, or in a budget first, and then look for grants that fit that, rather than twisting my projects to fit.
Yeah, I think grants. That a lot of times, like, that's an issue that I see also with, like, nonprofits that are applying for grants, and then they end up with, like, a new program that they only have this small amount of money for, and it's just, like, was this a program that you want to do? Because it's just going to burn everyone out. But yeah. I feel like, yeah, it's good to also, like, remember that it's not 40 years ago. Like, there's so many other avenues, like, there are people I know who are, like, Instagram famous artists, and they sell their work on there, and they do that stuff. So if that's your thing, it's fine.
Yeah.
There's no shame in it. Like, if you don't see shows that are showing work that is in your, like, what you're interested in conceptually or formally, like, apply to make a show, you know, that does that.
Yeah.
'Cause, like, not everything is going to be in the world there for you. Create those opportunities for yourself too, I would say, in any way you can. Like, talk to people about, oh, like listen when the older people, not me, but, like, you know, like, when, yeah, people who have been through it, like, they'll let you know what's up, you know.
And you too.
Yeah.
Cool. Last question. What is something you're excited about today?
Today? I'm really excited to go to Layla Weaver's show.
Yeah. I watched the trailer today.
Yeah, it looks really good. I know that Layla has been working really hard on this piece, and I think that will be awesome. And I love going and supporting other artists' work, especially artists who, like, make really wonderful things.
Yeah. Hearing her talk about her work is so cool.
Yeah. She's a smart cookie.
Yeah.